Support for WPR comes from Doulaying the Doula, offering birth and postpartum training and certification programs for medical professionals and other interested humans. More information about training is at doulaworkshop.com.
Support for WPR comes from Present Music, performing honest music with guest violist and curator Nadia Sirota, May 9th at 8 at the Milwaukee Art Museum. Tickets and info are at presentmusic.org.
Welcome to Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor, here to talk with you about what's new in healthy living, share some down-to-earth advice and some great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. Here's our toll-free number. Do you have a question for Zorba? Here's the number to call, 1-800-462-7413. Zorba, along with the calls, we always have some interesting research. What is it this time?
Yes, we're going to talk about how to eat beans in a flatulence-free way. Something that's on the topic and on the mind of everybody today. How can I eat those beans and still be in a nice social environment?
We have some flatulence.
Flatulence
research.
Advice concerning
beans.
We're all
looking forward to that. And what else?
And then lesbian brains and how they react differently to pheromones. And we'll compare that to research that recently looked at brains of gay men also. And see whether or not there's a biological relationship to homosexuality.
Okay, that coming up. And the recipe.
Coq au vin, it's French. This is chicken in mushroom and wine sauce, but with an Italian flair. Remember, those French love Italian food.
Okay.
Okay. There we go.
800-462-7413, our toll-free number. A listener with us now, Zorba, in Norman, Oklahoma. Hi.
Hi there.
How can we help?
Well, I'm 54. I've had knee surgery on my left knee twice and my right knee once, and now my right knee's acting up again.
No, bummer.
Oh,
bummer.
Yeah.
Yeah, bummer.
No, I'm real active. I hunt fish, and it's starting to bother me again.
Sure.
And I take glucosamine and chondroitin with MSM in it. And
good.
First, I'd like to know your take on that.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's some research that shows glucosamine and chondroitin sulfate may help. You know, the problems we have with any nutritional supplement is they are regulated like cosmetics. And that means even though it says glucosamine and chondroitin sulfate, it doesn't mean it has glucosamine and chondroitin sulfate in it. In other words, it may say X number of milligrams, but it might not really have that much. The potency cannot be guaranteed. So my recommendation, first of all, if you buy it, either buy a house brand, which would be the name brand of a big pharmaceutical company or a major drugstore chain or a discount store chain, because they're going to stand by their product. So usually the product is going to be good. That's step number one. Or even better, go to consumersreport.org and they rate them. And they'll tell you which glucosamine, chondroitin sulfate was really the stuff in there.
Assuming this is good stuff. Is it good stuff?
Well, did it work for you? Tell me, how much are you taking?
I take, 750 of the glucosamine and chondroitin, and then I'm not sure how much of the MSM was in this.
Mm-hmm. How do you feel? How's your knee doing?
Well, until about 6 months ago, my knees were, feeling really good. But now my right started acting up again, and I'm going, oh, no, if I torn the meniscus again.
So tell me, what kind of surgery have you had? You've had arthroscopy surgery? Was that
torn meniscus.
Torn meniscus. Okay,
yeah.
So you had that taken out through the scope? They took it out through the scope?
They went in and cleaned it up, and they did laser surgery on it, kind of cleaned it, made it smooth again.
Yeah, what else are you taking? Are you taking any anti-inflammatories at all?
I try to stay away from those because, they're tough on your digestive system.
Yeah, but I'll tell you something. If you've got some pain again, sometimes take that for 6 to 8 weeks. That might help you get it to settle down. That's what I would do. I'd recommend 2 Aleve tablets, generic Aleve, twice a day. And I like Aleve better than ibuprofen whenever I can because it's a twice-a-day pill, basically. And you double the dose in the bottle. It says 1 tablet twice a day. You do 2 tablets twice a day. I do that for about 6 weeks because you just may have some inflammation in the joint, and the glucosamine and chondroitin sulfate's not gonna do much for that. So how's your knee? Do you do any exercise, though, with your knee, any that a physical therapist or occupational therapist gave you or a trainer?
I haven't in a while. I mow my yard, and I said, I'm very active outside and stuff.
But, sometimes a little exercise with those – have you ever used those rubber bands or the weights that are on your feet and you do the leg lifts?
No.
You may want to, just because sometimes specific knee exercises can help. And you may just want to just go online, look for, you know, post-op knee exercises. And if you're good at looking at that stuff, I would do that also. Yeah. Good luck to you. You live in a great part of the country. You can do lots of outside activity. I love Boise. I've been there a number of times.
Well, he's in Norman.
Oh. I love Norman. Well, that's life. I love Norman. I love Boise. Norman, I've never been to, but it's a great part of the country.
Got to come and visit.
I'm going to do that. I've had an invitation to go down there to speak that I think I'm going to take, and Tom is laughing. Well, I'm
great
laughing, too,
country.
You know? It's
hey,
a great part of the country.
Never been there, but it's a great part of the
Never been there. It's a great place.
No, I was just invited to speak there. I was just
talking to too many people.
No, but I was just speaking in Florida at a SSM conference. It's a hospital group, and a person came up to me from Norman, who was a listener, and said, will you come and speak there? And I said, you give me an invitation.
No kidding.
I'll come there, quote, I heard it's a great part of the country.
Yeah. You sure you were in Florida?
I'm not sure of anything now, Tom.
800-462-7413.
Oh, gosh. You've got to have humor. You know, Tom, you call me on everything. Every little thing you call me on.
Thanks to the caller from Norman, Oklahoma. 800-462-7413.
I am never going to hear the end of
this. A listener now, Zerba, are you listening?
Yes, I am listening.
In Buffalo, New York.
Buffalo. That's a great part of the country. I've been there.
Hi.
Actually, I have been to Buffalo numerous times.
How can we help you?
Hi. Thanks for taking my call,
sure.
First of all. I read a few articles that claim that polycosanol is better than statin drugs because polycosanol does a better job of controlling cholesterol. It's also less expensive than the statin drugs, and that it has no side effects, whereas statin drugs do have side effects, including possible liver damage.
Uh-huh.
I'd like your opinion.
Yeah, well, I'll give it to you. First of all, who's selling you the polyglosamol?
Polycosanol.
Uh-huh. How much is that a month, by the way?
I don't even know. It's very inexpensive.
Well, let's talk about the statins. You bring up some good points. Statins are expensive. They're costly. There are now two generic. There basically is one generic statin. There'll be a second one within about 6 months. Zocor will start to be generic also. And you make them cheaper by getting them a bigger pill and dividing them up. For instance, Zocor 80 milligram tablets cost the same as the 20s. So I tell people you take an 80 and you divide it in a quarter and you take a quarter every day and it costs you a quarter as much. So you immediately lower the price that way. It's a great way to do it with a pill splitter. And if one is a little bit bigger than the other for a statin, it doesn't matter.
Not a big deal. Yeah.
Statins are in a class by themselves because they don't just lower cholesterol. That's not the issue. They stabilize the cholesterol plaque. It's the plaque in the body that's stabilized that seems to make the difference. If plaque is fluffy, it's more likely to rupture and hemorrhage and cause a clog. And if plaque is firm, it's less likely to do that. And the statins make the plaque firm. They don't just lower cholesterol. The other thing is, I don't believe their data. I don't believe it a shred at all. I think it's what the information they're selling you, wherever you got the information on the web, is probably because they want to sell you their product. You have to have a head-to-head study with the supplement you're talking about and the statin, double-blind, placebo-controlled. Look at it. You got to have enough people, not 20 people or 10. You've got to have probably about 400 or 500 people at minimum to power it. And if they have data like that, double-blind, placebo-controlled study for a statin, then I would, then I certainly would consider it and look at it. But usually that's not the way. What they usually do is they have 5 people or 10 people, and it's Joe and Ethel and Fred and Jessica, and they've taken the drugs and measured them. So, you know, you can tell I have a kind of strong feeling because there are a lot of supplements out there where people want to sell you a bill of goods, and they say this is as good as a statin, and especially when they say no side effects. I don't believe anything exists that has no side effects. Even water, if you drink it too much, can produce a side effect. So whenever they say no side effects, it raises my antenna, and I go, what are you trying to sell me? It's kind of like a pill that cures cancer, is great for sexual dysfunction, makes your hair stay on end. You know, one pill that does everything is sort of the same thing. So you can tell I've got a strong opinion about this.
Okay.
Now, are you on a statin? What statin are you on?
Lipitor.
Lipitor. How much? How many milligrams?
Oh, I don't even know. I don't have the bottle in front of me.
Okay. What you want to do, there are a couple things. The generic Mevacor, which is lovastatin, L-O-V-A-S-T-A-T-I-N, for many people will work as well as the Lipitor. And it's generic. It's now, there are 2 or 3 companies that make it. It's become much cheaper. I would go talk to your doctor and do that. And I'll tell you why. The people at Kaiser Permanente, big HMO, big group, I've got a lot of respect for them, started putting people on generic Mevacor, which is lovastatin, and they've managed to get 80 80% of the people off the more expensive drugs, like such as Lipitor. So 80% of the people can be controlled now on a cheap generic alternative. That's what I would do. Yeah. Or I'd go to the 80-milligram tablet and I'd break it in quarters and see if that would work for you.
Thanks a lot to the caller. What's the name of that pill that does everything that cures?
Yeah, right. That's right. Right. Good for sexual dysfunction. Yeah, yeah. Puts there. I can't remember. I can't remember. But I know it's either it comes. It's either manufactured in Norman, Oklahoma, or Buffalo, New York. Or maybe Boise.
Definitely not Boise. Definitely
not Boise. Not Boise.
You know, you mentioned pill cutters. I have one of those things, and I cut my
fabulous
statin.
Yeah, right.
But it's harder to cut now. Those things, the blades must get dull after a while.
Yeah, the blades probably get dull. Well, you have to call your doctor and ask for another pill cutter.
Yeah.
And
how much do those things cost?
I don't know. $2. You buy them at the store. They're at stores.
You can buy them at a drugstore.
Yeah, they're a couple dollars. They have pill splitters. You don't have to get it free. You can go to the drugstore and get them. The blades probably do get weak after a while.
800.
That's all. You want to know what to do with a weak blade on a pill splitter?
800.
Thank you, Tom. Next caller, please.
800-462-7413. Before our next caller.
Yeah, before. That's right.
Tell us all about this flatulence stuff.
Well, you know, it's on everyone's mind. You know, gas. It's a topic of conversation. But, you know, it's not just a teenage topic of conversation. You laugh. But older adults hate gas, especially women.
This is a very much a gender study.
Men couldn't care less. Don't care about gas. Yes, women care about gas all the time. Now, this is a cultural issue, though. There are a lot of societies, such as in Mongolia, where after a meal, if you do not pass gas, it means you haven't enjoyed the meal.
Oh, so it's a sign of having a good meal.
In Japan, as you may know, you have to belch. You have to burp. If you don't burp or belch either during the meal or after the meal, you haven't enjoyed the meal.
Wow.
So there's a cultural thing here. But be that as it may, we know that there are certain foods that cause a lot of gas. Beans. Right. And so there are two strains of bacteria that Venezuelan researchers looked at. Lactobacillus casei, it's called, and Lactobacillus plantarum. And these are what you call protobiotics. Mm-hmm. The idea is that you take them before you have a problem or you use them to see. Now, the interesting thing is this. Flatulence gas is released by bacteria that live in the large intestine when they break down the food. Okay? You break down the food. Fermenting makes it much more digestible. And the main bean that they looked at were black beans. Get the name of the black bean. Phacelius vulgaris.
That's vulgaris. The name of the black bean.
Well, vulgaris means common, but vulgar in our language means, you know, it has other meaning besides common. So legumes are an important side of nutrient, but the problem is they're limited by gas. So what happens is, especially in places, South America, Venezuela, they ferment beans to make them less gas-producing by cooking them in the liqueur, the liquid, from the previous batch. In other words, the previous batch of beans that they use, they save the liqueur. And what happens is the stuff that's in that liqueur seems to reduce the gas production of the bean when you eat the beans. So they looked in that liqueur and they found these two bacteria, Lactobacillus casei and Lactobacillus plantarum. And what they did was they pre-soaked beans with these two bacteria, fed them to rats. Now, rats really don't care about how much gas they pass. They're rats. They don't really care. But they fed them to rats, and they measured their gas. I guess they've got a gas model for rats, and they can measure the gas by sound or whatever. Lo and behold, it cut the gas by about half or three quarters.
So?
Well, what this may mean is like Beano, which is an enzyme that you take with beans that will help you digest the beans. Yeah. It may turn out that you can essentially have a protobiotic like a lactobacillus that we take that's part of yogurt that people take for mouth sores that they can buy in health food stores. It might be that you can take these bacteria that are benign bacteria that live in the gut before you eat your beans and you won't have gas.
So
now, isn't that exciting?
Where do I get these bacteria?
Well, they're not making them yet, Tom. This is early research.
So I know you want
to have beans, and your wife, Monica, doesn't want you to have beans and be in the house with her at the same time. I understand it. It's a social thing. But, but this really is important. We should eat more beans. Legumes are great. They're a great source of protein. They're a great source of fiber, and they are limited by flatulence.
And they taste good, too.
And they taste good, too. So this is not a silly study. This is an important study.
I never said it was.
Yeah, right.
I may have been thinking, but I never said it was. 800-462-7413. Question for Zorba, 800-462-7413, the number to call. And a listener now, Zorba in Norman, Oklahoma. Hi.
Hi. I had kind of an odd question here.
Okay.
I am one of those people that absolutely hates wearing shoes. Mm-hmm. If I could wear flip-flops my whole life, I would actually absolutely do it. And so I have gotten more active in a quest for being healthy and have been walking my dogs outside and have been walking them in my flip-flops that are, you know, the cheapos, the 250 ones, and I realize that that is really hard on my feet. But I don't like strapping on the tennies because it's just not me. It also makes me hot. So I was thinking, those new flip-flops that they make that are, have a more substantial sole, more like a tennis shoe, is that enough support?
Absolutely. That might do it. That is a great idea. You have two issues here. First of all, the support underneath it. And second of all, the flap that holds it on. And flip-flops, as you know, there's no flap around because, you know, you pull the shoe with you and you stand on it. But you don't have anything. There's no strap that goes around your foot. But, yeah, that might be exactly the right support. And that's what I would try. I mean, do you like sandals? You don't like sandals?
Well, yeah, sandals are fine.
Because sandals, you know, between flip-flops, the better flip-flops and sandals, you should be able to find something. The Dr. Scholl sandals I used to use years ago because they were, you know, they were made out of wood. I liked them on my foot. They felt much better. You know, Birkenstocks and others. There are lots of good sandals between sandals and flip-flops. You don't have to go to shoes. You know, a lot of societies, they don't wear shoes in Southeast Asia. They wear shoes to a special events, and if not, they wear flip-flops or they wear sandals because it's too hot. This has been going on for years. Will you wear flip-flops and sandals?
Well, of course I have to wear regular shoes to work because, you know, they're all against the flip-flops for safety reasons or whatever.
Where do you work?
But I work for OfficeMax Corporate.
Yes. Oh, they don't want you wearing flip-flops around OfficeMax. I can just imagine it would not be would not be in their style. They must have a dress code at OfficeMax and flip-flops are out. Why don't you change your job and go work like in a restaurant that's outside? They can wear flip on a beach.
Get them at least to have a flip-flop Friday.
Flip-flop Friday. That's what you should do. Is there a suggestion box at OfficeMax?
Well, okay, we suggest that it's the safety issue. We have a casual Friday, but not a flip-flop Friday.
Oh, I see. Casual Friday can't be flip-flop stuff. Can it be sandal Friday?
Oh, yeah, you can wear sandals, but it has to be like
strapped.
It cannot be a flip-flop.
Right, it has to be strapped. But I can understand that. Here is you're lifting a 50-pound box of paper clips, and you flip on your flip-flops, and all of a sudden it's workman's comp, and that flops them.
Right.
So, yeah, sandals are great. Flip-flops with a better support are great. Those are the things. You don't have to wear a shoe for the rest of your life, except to
work. These people are lying to me. It will not hurt my feet.
No. Oh, did people tell you that the new flip-flops would hurt your feet?
Well, they said that if I wear, like, the normal 250 flip-flops to walk in, that I would hurt my feet.
No, no, no. You don't cause any harm to your feet. A lot of people don't like the way they feel, but they do not cause harm to feet. Wearing no shoes is an issue because of stuff that comes through your skin.
Here's a suggestion. Quit your job. Go to public radio. Everybody that works at public radio can wear.
Actually,
there's no dress code. Flip-flops, bare feet,
public,
shorts.
Public radio. Yeah, people come to public radio. Well, not just shorts, swimming suits. People walk in to the station with
anything
swimming
goes
suits.
In public radio
right.
land.
It makes no difference. There is no dress code in public radio because nobody sees you, right?
That's right.
Public
that's
radio.
Exactly.
Nobody sees you. But you can't come naked. That's about the only thing you can't do, right?
Well.
Yeah, right. We'll talk about that later. Good luck. You're not doing yourself any harm.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot for the call. I can't wear flip-flops.
Yeah, why? Because you're in
public
radio?
How sensitive I am. What a sensitive guy. Yeah. The little thing that comes up between your toes, it rubs my skin raw.
Yeah, I actually don't like flip-flops. But years ago when I traveled in Southeast Asia and I had tennis shoes and it was too hot and all they had was flip-flops, I learned how to use them. And
but they, it doesn't rub your toes?
Well, immediately when I came back, I stopped using them. I don't like the feeling in between my toes.
Yeah.
It tickles me.
Yeah. 800-462-7413. Guess where our next caller is,
Zorba? Is from Boise?
Hey!
Boise, there we go. Way to go, man. That's great.
Boise, hi.
Hi, Boise.
Hello.
How can we help you?
Oh, thanks. I have this feeling of like a mass or a bump or a ball or my foot's messing up or something next to my big toe, just underneath the second toe there.
Okay, so
like,
between
it really is prominent when I take my shoes off, say, and walk on a tiled floor, I can feel this little bump, and it's almost like if you make a fist and you make that tendon go back and forth over your front knuckle, it kind of feels like that.
Sure, so this is between the first and the second toe.
It's just towards the heel of the foot, underneath the second toe.
Underneath the second toe. Okay, now, is it painful when you squeeze it?
You know, not really. Sometimes I wonder if it's painful because I'm worrying about it so much and I'm feeling around in there.
Well, that might be the case.
When I squeeze it with my hand or with my thumb, I can't feel it with my thumb. I can only feel it when I walk on a floor.
Okay. Let me tell you what I think this probably is. There's something called a Morton's neuroma. Morton's neuroma. And what this is there are nerves between our toes. And sometimes the nerve itself gets a little bit swollen and becomes, sometimes it's a little bit tender or it just in our brain becomes sort of present. We normally don't think about the space between our great toe and our second toe. Morton's neuroma is sometimes treated with an injection of a little anti-inflammatory, such as a steroid, into the spot, into the swelling. Sometimes it's treated by changing a shoe. So you've got a bigger box, it's called. In other words, it allows your feet to sort of expand a little bit because the shoe you have may be too tight. And if that doesn't work, then it can be removed. And it's a very simple procedure. It's done with local anesthesia. And the podiatrist or the foot surgeon takes out this little nerve between the toe and it's removed. You get a little numbness there, but that nobody seems to be bothered
by. Would you do it if you were our caller in that order? Try the shot
first? Oh, absolutely.
First?
Well, the first thing I would try is changing the shoe.
Changing the shoes.
Change the shoe first. If that doesn't work, then I would call the doc and or the foot, the podiatrist, and see about an injection. And if that didn't work, I frankly would have it removed because if this is a Morton's neuroma, and it doesn't get better after 3 to 6 months, it's not going to get better.
Even if he would go to flip-flops?
If he would go to flip-flops for the rest of his life, yes, that might add. Well, but that's changing the shoe.
That is changing the shoe.
Right. You've got to give yourself a little space because you may be pressing on it. Now, this is about four times more common in women because women wear narrower shoes than men.
Right.
And it's much more common, as you can imagine, in urban areas like New York in women because they wear high-heeled shoes.
Right.
You know, with a very small shoebox, you know, this little box, which is where
totally
you put
your foot. Totally uncomfortable.
Totally uncomfortable and stylish. So, you know, I think I would also stop wearing the 3-inch spikes.
Good advice to our caller. Thanks a lot. Appreciate the call. Zorba, time for a grammar lesson.
Grammar. Oh, grammar.
Today's lesson.
I love grammar.
Today's lesson,
students, from
comes courtesy of Pat in Oshkosh, Wisconsin.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
Pat writes, your listeners have done such a fine job of getting you to pronounce El Dante. Now,
and lozenge. And lozenge.
Okay, right. Now, how about leaving off the final T of bon appetit?
Bon appetit.
Bon appetit.
It's bon appetit? It's not bon appetit.
I thought it was bon appetit, too.
Yeah, well, maybe we're both wrong. Let's see. What are her credentials? Give me her
just
credentials.
Just plain appetit will do it, says Pat in Oshkosh, Wisconsin.
Okay. Yeah. No, but let's cite her source. What's her source?
Pat.
Pat's source.
I don't know if it's a he or she.
That's right. Pat, right. One of those names where you don't know if it's a he or she. So that is Pat's source. So, okay. Well, I automatically assume anyone who's
bon
interested
appetit.
In grammar
bon appetit.
Is my school teacher.
Bon appetit.
Bon appetit. Doesn't sound right to me. Does it sound right to you?
Bon appetit.
Bon appetit.
You sort of hint at the T.
How I see.
I think
you hint. I got it. Let me see if it's correct.
You don't
emphasize. Let me get it. Bon appetit. Yeah,
sounds
bon
good to me.
Yeah.
So, thank you, Pat. I'm leaving the tee off of everything. Thank you, Pat, for that email, I guess. We always like hearing from you. Just send your comment, tip, or grammar lesson to
Zorba@WPR.org.
And we have more of your calls and our recipe, which is coming up next.
Which is coq au vin, chicken in mushroom, and wine sauce, the Italian flame of the French recipe.
So you'll want to stick around here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI Public Radio International. I'm Tom Clark, here with Family Doc Zorba Pastor on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Zorba loves to hear from you. Our toll-free number is 800-462-7413. Question for Zorba? give us a call. But before we take our next call, Zorba, it is, as you know, recipe time, and you say this is some sort of a French-Italian deal?
You bet. Coq au vin, which is chicken with wine, mm-hmm. literally, is a French dish that I happen to love. I made it first made it when I was in college, and there are a variety of recipes. It's, you know, it's like sort of like beef stew in America, coq au vin, which means chicken with wine.
Right.
But this is chicken in mushroom and wine sauce, but it has an Italian flair because, among other things, we're going to use polenta.
Whatever that is.
And polenta, whatever polenta is. Polenta is made of corn. Mm-hmm. It's a traditional northern Italian starch, if you will. It's very, very nutritious. You slice it and you can grill it on a grill with some non-fat cooking spray or some olive oil. It's really good. When you look at polenta from a nutritional point of view, it's interesting. Compare it to spaghetti, and spaghetti is, you know, the typical Italian thing. You take 2 ounces of spaghetti, it's about 210 calories roughly,
uh-huh.
and 2 ounces of polenta happens to be 140 calories. So it has a third less calories per serving size, per 2 ounces.
That must be what this stuff is sitting next
That's
to me.
That's what the stuff is
that you're going
to
make me eat.
That you will eat. But polenta happens to be great, not plain, just like spaghetti isn't great plain. You want to have it with a little bit of sauce.
All right,
this is
that'll be coq
au vin, the Italian way, chicken in mushroom and wine sauce.
Let's do it.
6 large chicken thighs that are skinless.
6 large chicken thighs
that are
skinless.
Now, you're supposed to ask me why thighs.
Well, we usually have breasts when we
That's right.
Chicken.
Now, thighs have more flavor. They're dark meat, and they have more flavor. If you want to have, and they have more fat, of course, too, besides more flavor, they have more fat. But most of the fat is in the skin. So thighs are a tastier form of chicken than breast.
Well,
you could use chicken breast if you want to.
I prefer the taste of
yes,
the breast.
That's
the
right.
Taste
yes.
Of
we'll get into that later.
Yeah, all right.
2 tablespoonfuls of olive oil.
2 big tea olive oil.
That's right. 1 pound of mushrooms thickly sliced.
What's so funny about mushrooms? A pound of mushrooms thickly sliced.
I'm still back on the chicken.
Gosh, I'm
2 cups of onions.
2 cups of
chopped.
Onions.
Now, chopped. If you want to add a little bit of color, make them red onions.
Sure.
2 bulbs of fennel.
2 bulbs of fennel.
That's right. And you know where to get fennel, right?
In the fennel store.
Section of the fennel store. Right. That's right. Right. Sometimes it's a large grocery store. Sometimes it's the health food store.
Yeah.
Now, fennel has the smell of, do you know what it's, I'm sure you don't know what it smells of. It has almost a licorice type smell to it. It has a bit of a smell like that.
Mm-hmm.
Some people like it. Some people don't. I like fennel. My wife doesn't like fennel. If I make this dish, I won't put it in.
I thought fennel was something you shook out of a shaker thing, no?
That's seasoned salt.
Oh, yeah.
Seasoned salt.
Oh, I knew it was something that sounded
yeah,
like fennel.
Like
okay,
fennel.
Yeah, go ahead.
2 garlic cloves chopped.
I know what garlic is. 2 cloves of chopped garlic, yeah.
1 cup of dry white wine.
Cup of dry white wine.
Or you can do what I do is I keep a bottle of vermouth. I take a bottle of cheap, inexpensive vermouth that I find is fabulous, and that's what I use for my white
because
wine.
Because you're a very thrifty doctor.
Thrifty doctor. And it turns out I think it has a very good flavor to it. So 1 cup of white wine or better than that, vermouth.
Okay.
4 tablespoons of fresh basil.
4 big tea fresh basil.
If you're looking for a cheap place to buy fresh basil, I recommend Asian grocery stores or ethnic grocery stores. In the regular grocery stores, it costs you $1 or $2 for a little bit of basil. In the ethnic grocery stores, you can often get a whole bunch for like 50 cents.
Mm-hmm.
1 cup of low-sodium chicken broth.
1 cup of low-salt chicken broth.
Mm-hmm. That's right. 4-ounce can of tomato paste.
4-ounce can of tomato paste.
16-ounce package of polenta. They come kind of in a container, little plastic containers that look almost like sausage.
Like a sausage thing.
Yeah, but they're not sausage. They're corn.
No, I know that because I saw it here before.
Yes, you did.
Adam cooked it up and it's ready for me to eat. All right, okay.
And S&P.
Yeah. Salt and pepper.
That's right. Good. And you know what that is.
Yeah, I do.
Yeah. Preheat the oven at 350 degrees. Now, season the chicken with salt and pepper. Remember, only use grated pepper. And I recommend for salt, kosher salt or sea salt. It just gives a better flavor to it. Then in a large saucepan, heat 1 tablespoonful of olive oil on medium heat. Add the chicken thighs. Remember, they're skinless. Saute them for about 3 minutes. Transfer to a baking dish, you know, a typical sort of square baking dish.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in the same skillet, very important, if there's anything in the bottom of it, it's called the frond, F-R-O-N-D, and that's the good stuff. It adds a lot of flavor. It's the little particles that are in the bottom of the chicken that's left. You're looking at me incredulously.
All right. There's a word
frond.
For there's a word
the
for the
stuff
little
in the bottom.
Of...
It's called frond, and it adds a lot of flavor to
okay.
it.
Okay.
Add 1 tablespoonful more of olive oil. Then add the mushrooms, onions, fennel, and garlic.
Mm-hmm.
Saute for about 12 minutes or until the veggies are tender. Then add the wine and basil. Bring it to boil for 2 minutes. Then add the chicken broth and the tomato paste. Bring it to a boil and pour the sauce over the chicken, mm-hmm. pour it over the chicken, shove it in the oven, cover the baking dish with foil so it doesn't get dry, very important, 25 minutes, then uncover it, and then bake it for another 15 minutes. So the top of the chicken thighs are going to get a little bit drier, you know, and you'll get rid of some of the water that's in there. So what you're doing is putting the sauce into the chicken for those first 25 minutes,
right.
and then you're sort of drying out the outside so it's not soupy. And then serve it with 1 or 2 ounces of heated polenta. And why don't you get that? We're going to taste
that
polenta.
That's what this is that's sitting next to me. So why would
anyone eat polenta?
Is polenta sort of like a substitute for a spaghetti or?
Well, it's not rice and it's not spaghetti and it's not potatoes. It's made out of corn. So think of this as something that's like a potato, kind of a potato. But in northern Italy, it's a substitute. Let's see. So taste it. What do you think about it?
I don't know.
Well, come on. Give us an opinion. Have another taste. It's not making me gag. Just look at your face. It's not making you gag. Well, that's step number one, isn't it? Now, think about it with sauce on it. Have that second taste and tell me what it's like with sauce. Go ahead.
It's not a very appealing...
Come on, finish your food. That's what your mom would say. Children are starving.
I'm not going to eat this whole thing.
Because you don't have much. I'll take it. I'll finish it up. You don't want to eat after... No, I'll use my hands. No, I won't use my hands. I'll use the other fork. Anyway.
Oh, there is another fork. There's another fork.
Yeah, there is another fork.
It doesn't taste that good to
me. No, but it has sauce. It's in a polenta. It's great. You can get it in. Oh, I think it's wonderful. A little sauce on it.
Wonderful.
Mm-hmm. Well, you've got it. You can't have a lot of flavor in it. It's corn. Corn.
All right. Well,
You don't sound enthusiastic. You know, you've got chicken here. You've got a little wine. You mix
all the rest
polenta.
Of that sounds great to me. It's just this polenta stuff.
Polenta is good for you. So if you want a copy of our recipe, come to our website at zorbapastor.org, and the recipe will be there along with other fine stuff.
Or we're happy to send it to you. Just address your request to Zorba Pastor on Your Health, 821 University Avenue, Madison... I've got that polenta in my throat. Madison, Wisconsin, zip 53706.
CPR for you if polenta, you choke on polenta.
Be sure, if you'd like us to send you the recipe, to enclose a self-addressed stamped business-sized envelope. We're happy to send it along to you.
But I have to tell you something. I have to give an aside. If you choke on polenta, you probably won't need the Heimlich maneuver because all you have to do is bend over and spit it out. It's not like steak.
Great information.
Another advantage.
Another great
polenta.
Tip from Family Doc Zorba Pastor for you.
If you're going to choke on polenta.
You're on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. 800-462-7413 is our toll-free number. 1-800-462-7413. A listener with us now, Zorba, in St. Louis, Missouri. Hi.
I'm another polenta lover.
Oh,
actually,
great!
You're polenta not the only lovers one, Dr. Zorba.
Polenta lovers of the world unite. That's right. That's what I
you
say.
Can you see. Have a meeting in a phone booth sometime.
No. She's a public radio listener. All public radio listeners love polenta. It comes with the turf. When they get polenta as a premium, people are banging down the doors to contribute to public radio.
How can we help you?
Okay, I was a little bit curious. I've always been pretty fit. And about 2 years ago, I got some really strange symptoms, and I found out I have low blood sugar.
Okay.
And I've been—I really wasn't directed in the way to treat it properly, and I've done a lot for myself. But what I wanted to know was, do you know of any natural remedies for the symptoms and perhaps even an ability to reverse the low blood sugar?
Well, first of all, how low was your blood sugar? Do you know the number?
They said it was almost at hypoglycemic.
Uh-huh. Well, almost is different from being hypoglycemic. There's a big issue there. In other words, you cross the threshold, it's different.
Uh-huh.
Some people run a low blood sugar, and that's fine. That means that they exercise, they're fit, and they don't have much sugar running in their bloodstream. The issue with low blood sugar is that it's often related to eating refined sugars.
Uh-huh.
In other words, and you have a spike in insulin that gets rid of the refined sugar that's absorbed into your body, and then there's, if you will, little insulin left over and drops it a little low. So generally the treatment is to stay away from refined sweets as much as you can and baked goods and to go on to whole grains and whole wheats.
I've always done that though.
But let's go back to this low blood sugar. How symptomatic were you? Were you symptomatic?
I was very symptomatic.
How'd they make the diagnosis? What'd they do?
Well, Well, first of all, I felt a little bit, just out of sorts. I was falling asleep after lunch. Immediately I kind of drop into kind of a stupor and fall asleep for about 10 minutes and then get up and feel a little bit refreshed.
Uh-huh. What'd you have for lunch? I'm serious.
Well, I had a lot of whole grains. I've actually been having whole grains for a long time, eating pretty healthy.
Okay. Now, I want to mention that because back in the old days when I would fall asleep after lunch, one day I noticed the reason was I was eating sausage because I happen to love sausage, and I would be eating a sausage sandwich. And when I got rid of the nitrates and nitrites from the sausage and the size of the meal, I stopped falling asleep.
I'm actually allergic to nitrates, so I haven't had nitrates for years.
Okay, good, good. Because that can be an issue, nitrates and nitrites, back in the dark ages when I wasn't paying attention to nutrition.
Yeah, I totally understand. But it was, I was eating pretty healthy food. And I'd fall asleep. I was also very moody. Mm-hmm. I actually started exercising in the morning.
Oh, okay.
And I would lose every ounce of energy I had in that exercise.
Now, did they do a glucose tolerance test where they gave you blood sugar? They gave you sugar, rather, and then checked your blood sugar?
I don't think so. Uh-huh.
How many blood tests did you have?
I had one, but I had two doctors check it.
Yeah. The diagnosis of low blood sugar is controversial in medicine. It's a very controversial diagnosis as to whether it actually exists. I would get a hemoglobin A1C test.
Hemoglobin A1C.
That's the name of it. And what it does is it gives an average of what your blood sugar has been over 24 hours for the last 3 months, roughly, 3 to 4 months. That's what the test is. And if your hemoglobin A1C is like 5.5 or 6, it means that your blood sugar over that period of time is not that low. If your hemoglobin A1C is 4 or 3, which would be extraordinarily low, then I would fit with the diagnosis. But the hemoglobin A1C is much more sensitive. If you're in a normal range, I don't believe the diagnosis. Then I would look at other things to see what it is, and then I think it's on a nutritional basis. And I would look, instead of eating meals through the day, I would eat snacks.
Right, right. That's what I was told. I mean, basically, my doctors kind of threw me out of the office with that, and my other doctor said to me, "Do your own research." And that was the only way I've actually.
I would get a hemoglobin A1C, and if you're within normal limits, then I would deal with it nutritionally, and I might have breakfast in the morning because I think breakfast is important, especially if you have low blood sugar. But I would have a snack mid-morning, a snack at noon, a snack mid-afternoon.
Oh, I did. I already did. I eat nuts throughout the day, and I keep my meals small. I've been doing well. I kind of wondered if, I'm fit, I'm doing well. Like, is there a way to reverse something like this with the insulin dumping,
Well, this may reverse over time. This may just happen over time. The way we do it is you just treat it, as I say, with 6 meals a day versus 3 meals a day of a smaller amount. And that's the way you treat it. We don't reverse a lot of diseases in medicine. We don't cure heart disease. We don't cure diabetes. We don't cure high blood pressure. We just treat it. And that's basically what you have to do with this. So, good luck.
Thanks for the call.
You're welcome.
You would never throw her out of your office.
No, I would never throw her out of my office.
And tell her to do her own research.
No.
You would do
that. No, I would
research.
Never do that. No, I wouldn't do that. No.
Yeah. 800-462-7413, our toll-free number. And a listener now, Zorba, in Spokane, Washington. Hi.
Hi.
How are you?
Well, I have a question about noise sensitivity.
Mm-hmm.
I have been more sensitive than the people around me to noises all of my adult life. And it's gotten to the point now that we are fixing to put our house on the market because the basketball playing in the street is making me crazy.
Mm-hmm. How long has that been going on for?
Well, I'm 39. Mm-hmm. I would say probably since my teenage years.
When does it bother you? When you're trying to go to sleep at night or during
the day?
It
bothers me. Anytime it's happening, it bothers me. If I can't get away from it.
I understand that totally. That's a very annoying thing, and I'm a basketball fan.
You mean basketball playing in the street.
But when their kids are playing out on the street, it's bam, 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 bam. I think I'm kind of noise sensitive, too, actually.
Where do you... maybe you are.
I think I am. Yeah.
So where are you planning on living or moving to?
Well, we're just going to move to a neighborhood with larger lots, and we live in an old neighborhood in... A small-ish house on a small lot, and there's just no way to get away from it.
Sure, from the noise of the lot and the people around you. But sure. Do you think will this settle the problem? Sometimes that settles the problem.
Well, I don't know. But my real question has to do with something that did solve it temporarily, and that was a year and a half ago after my son was born. I had a pretty significant postpartum depression for which I took Paxil.
Right.
And
Good. I think it's right.
It was like magic.
All the drugs, all the SSRI drugs in that class, Prozac, Paxil, Zoloft, Lexapro, Celexa, I think they're all great. They all make a difference. Have you talked to your doctor about going back on the Paxil?
Well, I have, but I'm pregnant.
Congratulations on the pregnancy.
Thank you.
Yeah. But I would, when is your baby due?
Not till the end of the year.
Not till the end of the year. What I would do is, you know, we do use antidepressants during pregnancy. Oh, that's the baby?
Yeah. It is.
Oh, how cute. Yeah. An early public radio listener, huh?
Yeah.
Right.
What I would recommend doing, obviously, we stay away from drugs as much as we can during pregnancy, and you're right. You don't want to take an antidepressant during pregnancy unless you really need it. And this is something that's an annoyance. It doesn't sound like it's a dysfunctional thing. But when you are finished with the pregnancy, I would recommend you go on an antidepressant. And frankly, you probably ought to stay on it for a while. Now, some people who obsess like this stay on it forever. Some people take it intermittently. And I think, but I think I would look at that. But I'd also look at changing your environment, going, if you can afford it, to a house with a larger lot that has a little less, little more space and a little less noise. Great way to treat it in a non-pharmacological way. So,
how long can you safely stay on an antidepressant?
For the rest of your life.
Yeah.
Okay.
For the rest of your life. I have people who are lifelong on antidepressants. They stop the antidepressants. Their depression or their behavior comes back. They go back on them a lot. Most people try them with and without. Even the lifers, even the ones who are on it forever, they'll take times where they're off of it to see if they need it. And usually those are people, every time they go off, they feel bad and they go back on it over time.
So yeah, appreciate the call. Bad. Or you could say, Zorba, she could move to Norman, Oklahoma. You say that's nice.
Yeah, Norman, Oklahoma is one of the nice spots. I've heard that it's one of the nice spots to live in. I think I would move to Norman, Oklahoma. It's a great place. It's a great place to live. I'm going there. I've been invited. I just don't have the date.
More of your calls coming up here on Zorba, Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Zorba, you mentioned some research on a study on lesbians' brains.
Right. You know, one of the issues, and I think it's an important issue, is we're trying to discover whether or not homosexuality, lesbian and gay behavior, it has a biological basis.
Right.
That's an issue. And there was some research last year that seemed to show that gay men had brains that reacted differently to pheromones. These are chemicals that you smell that we believe are related to the human sexual response. And when I say we believe that we're related, these pheromones or these smells are thought to be an important part of sexual response, but no one has yet proven this in humans. We know in animals like insects and lower animals, they play a very, very key role in sexual behavior.
And,
but where they play it in humans, we don't know.
And that gay men research showed that the gay men's brains
reacted
more like
to
women.
Male. That's right. When you had male pheromones that were around, heterosexual women appeared to react to male pheromones, and gay men appeared to react to male pheromones, whereas heterosexual men did not react to male pheromones.
Yeah, interesting.
And these are things that you smell. What you do is you smell them. You also smell things that are ordinary odors. There are four ordinary odors that are done as controls. And then they also do brain scans, functional MRI scans, they're called, looking at which parts of the brains are highlighted. They ask them whether or not they find the smell pleasant or not pleasant. They grade it on a 1 to 10 scale. Is it really pleasant? Is it not pleasant? Do they feel stimulated or not stimulated? And it's all double-blind controlled.
This probably doesn't end the controversy.
Oh, no.
But it does lend some credence to the idea or the thought that there is some biological basis here.
Absolutely. And what they found was in lesbians, a very similar thing to what they found with gay men, that lesbian women were much more likely to react to women's pheromones than they were to male pheromones. In other words, they were more likely to be
stimulated. Their brains were more like men's brains in this regard than like women's brains.
Correct.
In terms of their
reaction. And then when they did the functional MR scanning, you know, to look at which areas, it turns out that that when the hormone was, when the female hormone was presented to a gay woman, you know, a lesbian, it seemed to be processed in the hypothalamus, in the area that we believe is related to sexual stimulation. Whereas the male hormone was not processed in the hypothalamus at all. It was processed in the scent area, the same as you would process, we'll say, the smell of licorice or the smell of basil or so on.
That's kind of interesting stuff.
Yeah, it's very interesting because what it shows is that there may be this biological basis, and it might be that with functional MRI imaging and looking at these pheromones, we may discover exactly what it is. The controversy is whether or not gay and lesbian behavior is learned or whether it's biological. This is one step towards really looking at the biological basis.
800-462-7413 is our toll-free number. A listener joins us now, Zorba, from Inchilium, Washington. Hi.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Zorba.
Hi. How are you?
I'm doing well, thanks.
How can we help you?
Well, I'm a scuba diver.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
I scuba dive on occasion. Mm-hmm. And here in Washington State, it's cold water. So
it's cold water. That's right. It is not the same as the Bahamas. And there are not a lot of coral reefs in Washington State, yes.
That's true,
especially
right.
Eastern Washington State.
So anyway, I wear a dry suit instead of wearing a wetsuit.
Of course.
And,
well, wait a minute. For those of us who don't do this.
Yeah, you better explain it to Tom.
What's the difference between a dry suit and a wetsuit?
Well, in a dry suit, you stay dry. In a wetsuit, you can still get wet, but can stay warm.
And what happens is a dry suit you use for those areas that are much colder. A wetsuit you can use when it's a little
colder. Are they
cold.
Made out of different stuff?
Yeah. It's a totally different thing.
Yeah,
right.
Different material.
Right. And the wetsuit, when you get in the water at first, it's a little cold, and then your body warms it up, and it feels really pretty.
Oh, okay.
I've worn them. It feels comfortable after a few minutes.
Thanks for the education. Go ahead.
Okay. All right. Anyway, on my dry suit, I have a neck seal and wrist seals, and there's a rubberized zipper to keep all the water out.
Right. You're dry on the inside.
Mm-hmm. And on my neck, I seem to be getting an allergic reaction from the seal.
Oh, interesting.
So every time I dive in my dry suit, I actually turn into a redneck, literally. My neck turns red. Uh-huh. It starts getting itchy. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it swells up a little bit. Mm-hmm. And
sounds like it, doesn't
I was
it?
Wondering what I could do for that.
Well, I'll tell you what I would try. I would try before the dive is I would put on a steroid cream. I would put on a more potent steroid cream, nothing you can buy over the counter. I would initially try, I'd either use a cream or an ointment. I'd try triamcinolone. It's just the initials are TMC. T as in Tom, MC, cream. And I would try the 0.1% cream or ointment. And I'd rub it on your neck before I put on the dry suit and just see if that works. Because it sounds like it may be an allergic reaction. And if you just put the steroid cream on it before you, you know, put on the dry suit, it's not as if you have to, you're doing this every day, right? How often do you dive?
Oh, maybe a couple of times a year.
Yeah, that's what I would do. I'd probably initially try the ointment because it's more potent and it's more likely to stay on the skin.
Well, I was, I didn't really want to use creams ahead of time because, number one, that would get pretty messy. Mm-hmm. And somebody had suggested Vaseline.
No,
but
I don't.
That's petroleum-based, and I think that will deteriorate the seal.
Oh, it may. Then what I would do, if you find the ointment messy, what I would do is put on the triamcinolone cream an hour before you go in the water. And what I would do is I would put it on, and it will absorb into the skin. It won't be messy at all.
Okay.
Don't put it on just before you go in. Put it on like a half an hour before. So you're basically going to pre-treat the skin with an anti-inflammatory before the allergic reaction. You follow what I'm saying?
Yeah.
In other words, you're going to do it beforehand. Then use the it's a vanishing cream. Your skin will not be tacky. Then stay away from the ointment.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
No. I agree about the
suggested putting saran wrap around my neck first.
well, you could. Saran wrap could work. And frankly, the saran wrap with the cream will work even better.
Oh,
because
really?
When we want high absorption of the cream, you do that. But I think I'd do the cream first. And if that fails or it doesn't do it enough, then the cream with saran wrap will probably do it. That's an old Dr. Kellogg who came to Oregon, around Madison, Wisconsin. I'm outside of Madison and came there in 40. He used saran wrap a lot on dermatitis.
Oh, interesting.
I have a question for you. What are you diving for? King crab, oysters, sunken treasure?
Actually, we were doing a little bit of work on our ferry railing because the river goes down. We're right on the Columbia River.
Uh-huh.
And
nice
in anticipation of the spring runoff, they let the river down. Mm-hmm. And so we had to put stoppers on the rails. so the ramp for our ferry wouldn't fall into the water.
The ramp for your ferry? You've got a ferry boat that you use?
Yeah, it runs every day. It's, you know, get people across the river. Uh-huh.
But it's your ferry boat? You own the ferry boat?
No, I don't own the ferry boat, but they call us. They call team.
They call the dive team. They say, come on and help. Can you help us with the ferry?
That's right.
Cool.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's nice of you guys to do that.
Yeah, thanks.
That's very nice. It's a nice public service thing. Yeah, I would try the cream. That's what I would do. That may do it. And besides, when you go to the Bahamas, you'll definitely, you don't need to wear a suit at the Bahamas, do you?
No, you don't.
So it's only Spokane, so.
Right. I know, really different having warmer water.
Yes, it is. I bet it's a whole trip.
Good luck with it.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you for the call.
Okay, bye.
Bye. 800-462-7413. Let me get a question in here, Zorba, from the Zorba Pastor on Your Health inbox. This one comes from Margaret in Fort Atkinson, Wisconsin, who writes, I'm on the antidepressant Effexor, and it's working great, but not quite great enough to call into a radio show without getting nervous. So thus the email instead of the call. The trouble is the Effexor gives me night sweats. I've been on it about 6 months. I'm also a bit more tired during the day. I'm wondering if there's a way that I could avoid gross, soggy sheets and give myself more daytime energy with a single solution.
Well, one solution is to lower the dose and see if that makes a difference. So that would be one thing. I'd talk to your doctor and see if a lower dose of Effexor might work for that. That'd probably be the first thing that I would do. If not, there's another drug in that class called Cymbalta, which may not give you night sweats, or maybe a different antidepressant with it. But with a lot of drugs, if you change the dosing, sometimes you get rid of side effects. Not with all. Good example are the statins. At the higher dose, they're more likely to cause muscle aches. At the lower dose, they're not as likely to do it. So I think I'd change the dose. I think what I would do is try that first, but I'd call your doctor first.
Is that a common thing with Effexor?
It's not totally unheard of. I don't know if it's like 5% or 3%, but it's not a rare event.
Margaret, thanks a lot for the email.
Thank you.
And if you want to contribute to crashing our inbox, send us your tip, question, or comment to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Zorba, thank you.
A pleasure, Tom.
For a copy of this week's recipe and all things Zorba, visit us on the web
at ZorbaPastor.org.
Don't forget, you can call us anytime at 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's produced by Adam Friedrich. Our executive producer is Charles Monroe Kane. Brad Kohlberg is our technical director. Gigi Holland fills your recipe requests. Our theme music by Ben and Leo Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark. Expecting your return for the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
For a copy of today's show, call the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0609Z. To buy Zorba's book, The Longevity Code, Your Personal Prescription for a Longer, Sweeter Life, or to pick up a copy of Zorba's Heart Healthy Cookbook, just go to our website at ZorbaPastor.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.